Support comes from the Missouri Forest Products Association, saluting Earth Day on April 22nd with an ongoing commitment to help offset carbon emissions with sustainable harvesting of Missouri forests. Details at choosewood.com.
Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Rachel Lipman. The way we understand our past has a pivotal impact on how we think about society today. And the history lessons we were taught in school are a big part of our understanding, whether or not they were accurate. Joining me today to talk about how we can refine our understanding of American history to paint a more complete picture of our country are Flannery Burke. She's an associate professor of history at St. Louis University. Professor Burke, welcome to St. Louis on the Air.
Thanks for having me.
Quincy A. Rose is the dean of the College of Education at Harris Stowe State University and a member of the Missouri Advisory Board for Educator Preparation. Dean Rose, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for the invitation.
And Rob Good is a retired high school history teacher, as well as vice president of the Missouri Council for Higher Education's Board of Directors. Rob Good, welcome to St. Louis on the Air.
Thank you. And it's Missouri Council of History Education.
Just history Education. So, I will make sure to correct that right now. Rob Good, I'll start with you with this question. What was the biggest myth or gap in your understanding of American history, and when and how did you learn that it was wrong or incomplete?
I guess the biggest gap I had was that I was not presented many stories of people of color. All through my elementary, high school, well, you know, outside of a few discussions of Native Americans, indigenous people, in a very stereotypical way, I did not know very much about that history. And it wasn't until college that I began to be exposed to stories that brought the experiences of people of color into the broader narrative.
Dean Rose, how about for you? What was the biggest gap or myth that you had about American history?
Yeah, I would agree with Rob as well. You know, at one point in time in my life, I realized that what I was learning in the school system and what my parents were teaching me at home were two different things, and there was a huge gap. There were things that I was learning about at home. My parents, as civil rights activists, were telling me a different story. So clearly there was a gap that was missing compared to what I was learning in the classroom.
Dean Rose, was there something very specific that your parents taught you that you realized you hadn't heard of in school kind of, you know, through that entire time?
Yeah, a lot of the stories as it relates to the purpose of why civil rights was such an issue. It just kind of was glossed over, and that's my early memory. And then I went on to learn that there was much information about slavery and just the role of African Americans and the contributions that they had made. I was not learning that in the school system. So there were so many gaps, so many things that weren't being taught, but those are just a few things that pop in my mind. You know, the African American contribution definitely was not taught in my school system at all.
Flannery Burke, how about for you? What's your biggest myth or gap that you realized later existed?
So I grew up in Santa Fe, New Mexico, and there was a lot of public history directed at teaching locals that the first colonists in the region were Spanish, and that the Spanish were in what is now the United States, even before English colonists were. And I was very confused all the way until college as to what happened in between the arrival of those Spanish colonists and the U.S.-Mexico War. So there was this gap between the Spanish and the French colonial regions of what became the United States and what's traditionally taught in U.S. history classes, which is a story of English colonization and then English-American progress westward.
Flannery Burke, was there a time in your classroom where a student taught you something that you didn't know, and what was it?
Absolutely. I learn from my students all the time. What springs to mind is not from a student per se, but I brought a group of international students to St. Louis in the spring of 2015, and they were curious about the historical roots of the Ferguson Uprising. And we were in Ferguson one evening, and a woman there taught us that Ferguson had been a sundown town. And until 2015, I did not know that. So I had been living in St. Louis for a while, for 10 years, and I didn't know that Ferguson had been a sundown town.
And just for those listeners who may not be familiar with the term, a sundown town was basically one where blacks were not allowed to be in the borders of the town past sundown because their safety wasn't insured. Am I remembering that term correctly?
Yeah, so a sundown town referred to a town where blacks could come to work, but they were physically threatened if they stayed past sundown. You know, so if they tried to make their lives in that town, they were physically threatened, but they were free to work for white people in that town.
Teen Rose, how about for you? I know you spent some time as a classroom teacher in Delaware. What was something that a student of yours taught you?
Well, it's interesting. I spent a lot of time in the classroom in Delaware, but I'm originally from Baltimore, and I actually was going to mention, you know, in my time here in St. Louis, some of the things that my students have taught me. But, you know, I think that's one of those things that we do as educators. We're always open to learning. But one of the things that my students have taught me since I've been in St. Louis, I did not know about the rich history as it relates to Annie Malone. I did not know a lot about the rich history as it relates to St. Louis. And oddly enough, I did not know a lot about the Del Mar Divide until I arrived at St. Louis. So my students have taught me that information. And again, that's information that was not in the history books. Should have been in the history books throughout the country. Might have been here known in St. Louis, but certainly I was not made aware of it prior to coming to St. Louis.
And remind us who Annie Malone was, Quincy Rose.
So from what I understand is Annie Malone was a philanthropist here in St. Louis. And as a result of contributions that Annie Malone had made, she is the person who helped to focus on the impact of St. Louis, helped to make sure that the community in St. Louis kind of galvanized to support folks of color as well. So that's my understanding of Annie Malone. And I kind of want to add to that, I did not also know, and it's kind of interesting, being the dean of the college here at Harris-Stowe State University, I did not know the wealth of knowledge that came from Harris-Stowe State University that is throughout the country. So there's many different layers. Annie Malone, the history of Harris-Stowe State University, the impact of Harris-Stowe State University throughout the country that I've learned since I've been here.
Rob Good, what was something that a student taught you about history that you realized you didn't know?
Well, lots. I think the first thing I learned was humility, that my students had such a broad and complex understanding of the past and their own experiences. I'm thinking about what Quincy said about the home education that she received. And I often didn't understand those contexts. And so more specifically, though, perhaps stories about migration and movement, and particularly in the setting where I taught, there were students whose parents had migrated from the South, but there were also students whose parents had migrated from Eastern Europe and from Africa and from Asia. And to hear both the commonalities and the differences in those stories, I learned a lot and became more and more humble each year that I learned from my students.
We want to hear from our audience. What's been a recent historical revelation for you? You can give us a call at 314-382-8255. That's 382-TALK. You can send us a tweet to @STLOnAir or email us at talk@stlpublicradio.org. Here is how some of our listeners answered that question. Mary writes that she never knew about Henry Shaw's 11 enslaved people and how they helped build the garden and his selling of Esther after she tried to escape. She says, "I've spent many hours at the garden and there was no mention of this legacy. I was an American studies major at SLU. We never heard that the Jesuits were among the first to bring enslaved people to St. Louis." Wally writes, "The war on legitimately elected governments and the wholesale slaughter of black voters and electeds during Reconstruction. I knew Reconstruction was rough," he says, "but the reality is just insane." And we heard from Sarah, a member of our St. Louis on the Air Facebook group. She writes, "I always took as true the myth that George Washington's teeth were made of wood. In fact, they were made of ivory and the teeth of enslaved people." She adds, "I also did not know about Juneteenth until my mid to late 20s. I spent 13 years at a private Catholic school, 4 years at a public liberal arts school, and 3 years of law school. There was no mention of that. Quincy Rose, I'll direct this question to you first. Why do all of these gaps and myths that we've heard about matter?
Well, they matter because ultimately when we talk about educating students, we want our students to be holistically prepared. And that what that means is whether it is in an elementary school environment or even in the higher ed environment, if there's a gap in history, then we have not adequately prepared students to understand the contributions that indigenous people, African Americans, and others have made. So that means that they don't understand themselves. So it's a gap that ultimately goes into not understanding who you are, not understanding who you came, where you came from, not understanding the contributions of others. And so that tunnel vision that unfortunately has happened with many of us, where we've learned select history, ultimately has a negative effect on us and does not help us to understand who we are, our contributions, and where we came from, and ultimately to understand the value of where we're going.
Flannery Burke, why do these gaps in myths matter?
So if a student comes to me and says, why have I never heard about this before, that generally means three things. It means that student is curious and intrigued by that subject. It means that that subject speaks to something that they value deeply. As Dean Rose just mentioned, maybe it has to do with their particular history, their family history, where they come from. Often when students come to me with these questions, it has to do with justice. And it means that their previous education has not addressed the subject. There's no way for K-12 education to address everything that has happened in history. So I don't necessarily hear it as a bad thing if a student comes to me with that question. But my answer has to address what is deeply valued by the student that's part of that question. So their justice, is it justice? Is it their past? And how do I continue to feed the curiosity that students are bringing to that question? So I think, the gaps matter because it means that student intellectual curiosity is not being fed.
Rob Good, why do the gaps and the myths matter?
I think because they bring to light issues that allow students to be active agents in the democracy. That they, these stories oftentimes bring to light issues of power, privilege, place. And as Flannery mentioned, students are asking questions around issues of justice and how, why are we the way we are, particularly in moments like now. They wonder, how did we get here? One specific example that we would teach in a team talk class I taught on African-American history with an English teacher of color was to look at the social construction of race, that this was a created concept and it was created for a particular reason. So if you understand that why and how race was constructed, then creatively we can start thinking about how do we go about deconstructing it.
So many more important things to talk about when it comes to history education in the United States. We do need to take a quick break, but we will be back with Rob Good, Flannery Burke, and Dean Quincy Rose shortly. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU.
Support comes from the Missouri Forest Products Association, saluting Earth Day on April 22nd with an ongoing commitment to help offset carbon emissions with sustainable harvesting of Missouri forests. Details at choosewood.com.
The Gateway brings you the day's news from the St. Louis region and across Missouri. It also includes stories from the Illinois side of the river and our Metro East reporter, Will Bauer.
In Alton, in Belleville, in East St. Louis, in Edwardsville, in Cahokia Heights, at Scott Air Force Base, I'm Will Bauer, St. Louis Public Radio.
Listen to reports from Will and all of our journalists weekdays on the Gateway, on the STLPR app, and wherever you get podcasts.
Now back to our conversation with SLU history professor Flannery Burke, Quincy Rose, the dean of the College of Education at Harris Stowe State University, and Rob Good, a retired high school studies history teacher. Dean Rose, you brought up this idea of home education and what you learned about from your parents versus what you were getting in the classroom. Is this just when your parents were teaching you this? Was this something that they felt you needed to know to, you know who you were? Or what were their motivations for kind of adding to this education that you were getting at home versus what you were getting in school?
Yeah, my parents really believed that they wanted us to be empowered through knowledge. They wanted my sister and I to be empowered through knowledge. And so the more opportunities that they could give us to share information with us, to expose us to experiences, to teach us about the history of our community, the better. Because ultimately they wanted us to be empowered and to share that information that we learned. And I think that that's still true today. I want to believe that that's still true today, that families are empowering kids and students with experiences and making some things relevant so that students can be able to apply what they're learning to everyday life. So my parents were really big advocates on making sure that we could connect with what was going on in our community and ultimately to have an impact.
I mean, did you feel empowered by what you were learning at home as opposed to maybe what you were learning from the school, or empowered in a different way perhaps?
I did. I think Flannery mentioned earlier about the role of discovery. When you're in a household where discovery is encouraged, and that's what we do as educators, we try to encourage discovery, where you can ask questions, where you can ask, well, why are things the way that they are, or why does this person on the street, you know, who are they, why are they homeless, right? So when you're in a household where discovery is encouraged, you feel empowered compared to perhaps in an environment where you are suppressed, you're not allowed to ask questions, and you're not allowed to discover. So absolutely, I felt empowered and encouraged.
We asked our listeners what have been some of their gaps or myths in history, and we've heard from quite a few of you. Cecilia is giving us a call from St. Louis. Cecilia, go ahead. You're on St. Louis on the air.
Yes, good afternoon. I'm so glad that you're discussing this topic because it is very, very important to me. I am a playwright by experience and have been looking into how the state of Missouri is dealing with the topic of slavery. And what I've discovered is that the very standards of the state do not mention slavery or Civil War. They simply mention looking at history before 1870 and after 1870. As an African American, I have been shocked by that, because not only are the examples of African Americans who contribute to Missouri history important, but also the contributions of white allies that have actually helped in the state of Missouri. For example,
Cecilia, real quickly, just to make sure that we're understanding you correctly, when you say the standards, are these the guidelines that teachers have in order to kind of be able to prove that they are teaching the topic correctly? Or I want to make sure I understand what you mean by standards.
These are broad standards that are used to guide teachers in a general way, but not in a specific way. I'm sure you could ask your panel the question, are there any tests that are given on history? And the answer to that at the state level is that there are no tests that are given on history. So the accountability for what is taught in history is not there. People can pretty much say if they want to that the Civil War was a problem because of agriculture in the South.
And Cecilia, actually, thank you. We have a perfect guest to address that comment. Quincy Rose is the dean of the College of Education, and she's also on the Missouri Advisory Board for Educator Preparation. Dean Rose, can you address Cecilia's concerns a little bit just about what teachers need to teach in history in Missouri?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. It's interesting that you asked that question, Cecilia, and you're correct. Unfortunately, while there are some standardized tests that address history, they certainly don't really cover the broad spectrum as it relates to history. They're very limited. And so one of the things that I'm excited about is being a part of a team here at Harris Stowe State University and through the state of Missouri that's taking a look at our assessments as a whole to make sure that we are not only teaching students students the information that covers history, but covers that broad spectrum of history, contributions that have been made in history, and so on. Because what we're finding is that students are very limited in their knowledge, and so then when we go to assess them, we're assessing information that oftentimes they haven't been taught. So you're absolutely correct, and I'm excited at the fact that we're taking a look at assessments across the board to make those necessary changes.
Rob Good, I'm wondering if you could address that a little bit in terms of, as you were coming up and proving that you could teach, what did you demonstrate that you had to know in order to be able to get into the classroom?
There was one test that was being normed at the time. So it was a content and a pedagogy test. Currently, teachers to get certified to teach social studies, both secondary social studies, have to take a test that covers issues of world, US, history, economics, geography, and a couple of other subjects. But that is not a specifically keyed towards cultural relevancy, I would say, and culturally responsive teaching. My students' experiences, I adjunct at the University of Missouri-St. Louis and work with pre-service teachers, and they often feel that the questions are somewhat random. And so there was very little gatekeeping when I came through. There's a little bit more, but I don't know if those tests and those instruments actually determine the degree to which people have a broad and deep knowledge of U.S. history.
Tom is calling us from Afton with his take on the myths and gaps in history. Tom, go ahead. You're on St. Louis on the Air.
Thank you. My question, I graduated from high school in 1986, and when I was in elementary school and junior high in the 70s and early 80s, we knew names like, you know, Frederick Douglass, Langston Hughes, George Washington Carver, Harriet Tubman. In St. Louis, we knew about Scott Joplin. And in the broader culture, we had Roots, the Jeffersons, What's Happening, all the Norman Lear shows that took on issues of race. And I wonder, my question for the experts is, after that time, was the curriculum, like public school curriculum, did it sort of become regressive? Did they remove some of those people from textbooks? Because I knew all those names before I got to high school.
Rob Good, Flannery, did I hear you want to chime in there, or Quincy Rose?
I think one of the things that happened is that our curriculum has become very outdated, right? And so taking a look at what was taught in the past, oftentimes not only was the curriculum outdated, but also finding the time in a classroom setting for teachers to really teach that. Unfortunately, what we're seeing in a lot of K-12 settings is that teachers are having to blend a history lesson along with a reading lesson and a math lesson. So two things are a concern: outdated curriculums that need to be revamped, and then also factoring in the time that is needed to teach a proper history lesson consistently.
We're talking today on St. Louis on the Air with Quincy Rose, the Dean of the College of Education at Harris Stowe State University, as well as a member of the Missouri Advisory Board for Educator Preparation, Rob Good, a retired high school teacher and vice president of the Missouri Council of History Education Board of Directors, and Flannery Burke, an associate professor of history at St. Louis University. Flannery Burke, you are also an officer of the Missouri History Educators, and you recently put out a letter about the commitment to hard history education. You can find that on the group's website. What did you mean when you used the word hard history education in that letter?
So the term hard history has been used more widely by a variety of organizations. The National Park Service has been interested in what they call hard history lately. And it refers both to difficult subjects, it can be hard to talk about slavery. It can be hard to acknowledge, for those of us who are white, the benefits that we have as a result of slavery. And so hard refers to, you know, the emotional difficulty of the topics, but it can also refer to, you know, the fact that you have to learn a lot. And Reconstruction is a really complicated topic, and teachers don't always get the time, as Dean Rose just mentioned, to do that topic justice. So So, you know, history is hard. I have a colleague, Thomas Andrews, who teaches at CU Boulder, and he used to like to say, history is not rocket science, it's harder. So, you know, history is a difficult subject, but it can also require us to address difficult emotional subjects.
Rob Good, I want you to address the racial makeup of that organization. We heard Flannery mention that it can be sometimes hard for history teachers and people learning about history to realize the benefits of being white. I know the officers of the council are all white. The vast majority of the board is white. Is that an issue? And how do you address, you know, the need to do hard history when so many of the people kind of leading and trying to make this better are white?
It absolutely is an issue, and it's an issue that we're constantly working and trying to expand our network and build connections with people. It's, you know, you don't want to come up to somebody who is new to your organization as a person of color and say, hey, you want to join the board? It requires deep relationships and deep commitment. In the process of doing that, we have been explicit about making sure that the people that we include in both our presentations at our conference and our keynote speakers represent a wide variety of voices. Keona Irvin, who is a scholar from the University of Missouri, who has a great book on African-American women's history in St. Louis, was one of our keynotes last year. So that is, and it's an ongoing conversation and project within our organization. And I think that going back to what I said earlier, part of it, you have to recognize the humility that there are going to be limitations. When I taught African-American history, the first thing I would say to my students is, you might have noticed that I was white. And after the kids kind of chuckled for a second, we would spend on the first day talking about, well, what does that mean? And, you know, Carter G. Woodson, in a famous book of the 1920s, talked about the miseducation of the Negro and to the degree to which people like me who have been in charge of curriculum have shaped narratives. And so trying to approach that to broaden and expand our organization is constant work that we're seeking to do.
Dean Rose, I know we hear a lot about just kind of in general the positive impact that having a black teacher can have on black students. Is that impact even more important in topics like history where the color of a skin really can shape your view of history and understanding of it?
Absolutely, it is. Having a teacher of color or having a teacher who represents the students within that classroom matters in every aspect. It is critical, has been critical for years, having a teacher of color and specifically males of color in the classroom. Oftentimes, I'm you know, wondering why I hear about males of color in the classroom being a priority as it relates to discipline. But when we're talking about educating, you don't often hear about that need. So I'm definitely an advocate and support programs and institutions that are preparing teachers of color as well as males of color to teach in the classroom. History, math, across the board. We know the evidence shows us in research that students absolutely succeed when there is a person of diverse background that represents them in the classroom.
And how much, too, is just, you know, the shaped narratives and the different history? You know, Rob Good mentioned that he would do the whole, oh, as you may have noticed, that I'm white. As I asked, is it different, you know, for history in terms of just having these different narratives and understandings and a more complete picture, maybe?
Sure, because it makes it relatable, right? So if I'm teaching history as it relates to the African American struggle in a certain environment, while it's great to have any educator who's passionate about the subject that they're teaching, to have someone who students can truly relate to, maybe they have because of their diversity, or maybe they've had the experiences. It really does make a difference. And again, all of this goes back to having the environment where students are free to discover, explore, ask questions, so that they can make that connection in their own personal life. Because ultimately, we want students to be critical thinkers and lifelong learners. And if I have someone in the classroom who's teaching me a subject matter that I can relate to in a way that I can understand, hands down, it makes a difference in their success.
We need to take another quick break, but we will be right back with our conversation about changing history education in a minute. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Welcome back. We've spent the first parts of today's show with SLU History Professor Flannery Burke, Harris Stowe State University Professor and Education School Dean Quincy Rose, and retired high school social studies teacher Rom Good discussing gaps and myths in the way we learn about American history. We're going to shift gears a little bit now to how do we change this? How do we improve history education? Listeners, what would have made history education better for you? Give us a call at 314-382-8255. That's 314-382-TALK. You can send us a tweet at STL on air or email us at talk@stlpublicradio.org. On Thursday, we asked St. Louis University doctoral student Minaz Ahmed what her hope is as a scholar and teacher of history for how we evolve the teaching of history going forward. And she told us that she's actually taking a graduate course at SLU this summer that's specifically focused on pedagogy, which is basically how you teach something.
We take it very seriously in academics, in the history field of, how we're constantly, it's a really big deal to us. We're constantly trying to think, how can we teach better? How can we, especially in the way the world has changed just in the last 3-4 months, and how to engage students better, and how to have them connect to the history, and not in the sense of, the traditional old way of dates and facts and memorization. And yes, that is important as well, but having them being able to connect with kind of the humanity of history, and having them to be able to use that to maybe become better citizens of the world.
And Lindsay Manshack, a member of the Choctaw Apache tribe of Ibarb and a researcher at Washington University, had these suggestions for changing how students learn about St. Louis history.
There was a study by Illuminative that found that teachers rate Native American history as one of the most inaccurate and difficult subjects to teach. They say that within this study, 27 states make no mention of a single Native American in their K-12 curriculum. And the remaining 23 states where Native Americans are mentioned, nearly 90% of state-level history standards fail to cover Native people's history in a post-1900 context. And this leads to a very large void, which is then filled with racist sports mascots, over-sexualized portrayals of Native women, offensive Halloween costumes, and just inaccurate portrayals of Native American people. And the study even showed that policymakers on the policy level believe that in this invisibility stemming from lack of correct history curriculum has a negative effect on policy and policymaking for American Indians.
Flannery Burke, I know that representation of Indigenous people in history curriculums is something that you're really focused on. Based on what Lindsay Manshack mentioned in that, how would you create or design a history curriculum around Indigenous people that would, change some of these policy outcomes and change, the very limited scope that she mentions people get in terms of education of Indigenous people or about Indigenous people, excuse me?
So there's a great book called Why You Can't Teach U.S. History Without American Indians. And one of the things that that book handles especially well is this period after 1900. So there's a widespread misconception among non-Indigenous people that Indigenous people vanished, that they disappeared, that they kind of disappeared in the onslaught of civilization. And that's simply not true. So there are dozens of examples of how Indigenous people participated in the urbanization of the United States, how they participated in U.S. International engagements abroad, including military engagements abroad, how they advocated for themselves as sovereign people. So it's complicated. It's hard to teach that history, but it's what actually happened. So if we want to charge ourselves with the responsibility to teach what actually happened in the 20th century, then Indigenous people have to be present in that conversation. I think a great example, of course, is the recent decision on the part of the Washington, D.C. NFL team to change their name. And the National Congress of American Indians has been pushing for that change for years. So it's not that that history didn't exist. People knew that history. People knew the history of that activism, but they chose not to respond.
Does this need to be a separate class, or is this just you incorporate these individuals into your regular teaching curriculum?
I think it has to be both. And there are almost 600 tribes within the boundaries of the United States. So it's going to be impossible in a 15-week semester, how in the United States we how at the university level we normally teach history classes. So it's going to be impossible in 15 weeks to cover everything and cover it well. So I think we need classes both on Indigenous history and on U.S. history that incorporates Indigenous people. We also, kind of need to incorporate Indigenous history when we teach local history. So when we teach the history of St. Louis, and that history needs to be not just Cahokia, so not just pre-1500, but also the history that goes all the way up into the 21st century.
Mary is calling us from South St. Louis County with a question about history curriculum. Mary, go ahead. You're on St. Louis on the air.
Yes, I want to know what's being done now, this year, last year, and next year, to teach the real story of American history. And to answer your other question, I'm in my 70s and went back to school at age 60. I've got my college degree, but I went back to school to pick up extra things. And I had a history teacher who was excellent. And the way he did it was the textbook was reference only, and he had smaller books that dealt with subject matter pre the 1850s, post the 1850s, but we delved into those in depth, and it read like a story rather than chapters that keep breaking off, and it was much more in depth, which I really like. So if you could answer, what are we doing now with our schools to teach the real history?
Mary, thank you for that question. Rob Good, this seems kind of very much up your alley in terms of being a retired high school teacher. How important are textbooks, as Mary mentioned, and what role should they play in the classroom?
Textbooks are a resource that every student has, and textbooks have changed. It's been an interesting, Mary asked about what has been done. I think there's been an ongoing effort ever since the early 1990s. And even before that, this goes back to the creation of Negro History Week, which became Black History Month, and other associated attempts to bring different narratives into the school. Textbooks have changed. However, they don't necessarily do a great job of fully developing the breadth and depth of the story. They're textbooks. They're boring. So while they change a bit, there are also great places to open up the textbook and raise questions. So I'll give another concrete example. I was teaching a unit on Reconstruction, and there's a very famous Thomas Nast cartoon saying "Worse than slavery," which shows the KKK and the White League shaking hands. And in the background, there is, in that political cartoon, there is an African-American man who has been lynched hanging from a tree. It's a very stark image. And I was doing a lesson in class with that image, and I pointed it out and I said, and you see this here. And the student said, no, that's a wrong image. The textbook itself had literally whitewashed out the man that was hanged in the tree. And this was not early in my career. This was probably in the last 8 or 9 years of my career. So But when students realized that they could question the text, when they could question that authoritative voice in the text, that gave them a sense of power, that, that history is a contested and always developing process.
That's Rob Good. He's a retired high school history teacher and vice president of the Missouri Council for History Education. We're also joined on St. Louis on the Air today by Quincy Rose. She's the dean of the College of Education at Harris Stowe State University, and Flannery Book, an associate professor of history at St. Louis University. Dean Rose, K-12 curricula especially, because you have school boards, you know, with people with kind of different mindsets as to what should be taught. It can get so incredibly political. When you're teaching educators, what advice do you give to them to work kind of within the bounds of what they're given by the schools, by the curriculum, by what's provided, and then reaching out to other documents and kind of, you know, navigating what they feel their students need to know within the bounds of the district in which they exist?
Yeah, great question. One of the things that we do here at Harris Stowe State University, and it's really not just in the College of Education, I mean, we really encourage our students who are very much passionate about social justice and activism, we encourage them to channel that into research and also to do, put their foot in some curriculum development. So we're teaching our students to do a little bit with curriculum development. And then within the College of Education, we're also giving them the skills and the resources that they need to take that curriculum development into scope and sequence and lesson plan and unit plan development as well. So really taking their passion, whether it's for social justice or history as a whole, and then learning how to, as well as research, and then learning how to use that information in curriculum development. And so what we're finding is that it goes from being the mundane of just regurgitating information that has been taught to them to something that is passionate for them, something that they can connect with, and then ultimately teaching them the skills so that they can also have the instructional skills in the classroom. So that's key, right? Because they're taking ownership with it, and it becomes something that's important to them as well. And so what we're seeing is when these students then go out to the school system for clinical experiences, they're showing what they have learned here at Harris Stowe. They've learned about curriculum development. They've learned about lesson plan as well as unit plan. And so they're sharing that information with the schools that they visit for clinical experiences.
Rob Good, when you were in the classroom, you were in a district that had maybe a little bit more access to supplies just by virtue of it was one of the wealthier districts. But are there advice to high school teachers out there that you might offer when it comes to, you know, making resources and bringing in resources that the school isn't providing for them that, you know, they may not have the ability to access because of economics or a variety of reasons? How can they work within the confines of what they're provided and can afford to paint a more complete picture beyond the textbook?
There's a number of excellent websites that students can access or that teachers can access to gain curricular materials. A couple that just are off the top of my head. There is the Stanford History Education Group Project SHEG, which has both world and U.S. history curriculum using primary documents, lots of interesting questions. There's the Zen Education Project. There's Teaching Tolerance, which is the educational outreach effort of the Southern Poverty Law Center. There are a number of different places. Curriculum is out there that can supplement and strengthen what is sort of the standard fare in textbooks, which are produced and created for political purposes.
I want to take a couple of more quick calls here. Kim is calling us from St. Louis. Kim, go ahead. You're on St. Louis on the Air.
Hi, thanks for having me. I wanted to talk about how history is, how it may not be accurate. For example, there's a book I read called Mapping Decline. It was talking about a historical African-American neighborhood, Elmwood, where I grew up partially. And he was talking about that in his book, and he was saying that some of the people were sent to neighborhoods that were, you know, not so nice neighborhoods in the city. And I had to raise my hand while he was talking about it and say, you know, that's really not true. You know, my family was one of the first families to integrate Ladue. There were several families who went to Rittner. They went to lots of different districts. And then recently also, a friend of mine, we were taking the kids to go visit the History Museum, and they had a lot of Black history there, but it wasn't accurate. And I was saying that, you know, maybe the kids were really the ones who were pointing it out, like you said. So you said you were looking for a solution. I'm a teacher myself. I've written curriculum for the state for science. But what I recommend is that the nation as a whole, because a lot of times curriculum is written from national standards, but the nation as a whole have a place where kids can go and learn the African-American history, which is world history, where it's just there, sort of, and maybe model it like they have in Alabama outside where the church where the four little girls lost their lives. They have a great resource down there where you can go and learn African-American history. But if you could have something online, because teachers can't teach everything. There's not enough time in the day.
Kim, thank you. That's great advice. Franny or Burke, I want to go to you. Have you adapted the way that you teach a little bit kind of based on something that you've heard or learned or, you know, based on a correction? Real quick, how have you found yourself adapting?
Absolutely. And this actually goes all the way back to your first question of what have I learned from my students? Just this past term, I was teaching the second half of the U.S. survey, so 1865 to the present, for the first time in many years. And a student who hadn't attended class very much came to me and said, I don't think that people of color are adequately represented in your syllabus. And I thought I had given a lot of attention to people of color in the syllabus, but she pointed out that with the exception of that text that I just mentioned, Why You Can't Teach U.S. History Without American Indians, the authors of the other texts that I had assigned were white men. So when we had to move to online instruction in March, I quite intentionally went out and found lectures by people of color and by white women to take the place of some of the lectures that I was giving so that students could see experts in their field, experts in the field of U.S. history, delivering the information to them. So I think the information is out there. It takes time to find it. And it's so great to hear that Harris Stowe is giving their teacher candidates the time to do that curriculum planning, because it can be hard for teachers who already are burdened with so many things to also engage in the additional self-education that fortunately I, as a university professor, had the time to do. So the most important thing is to give time to teachers, give training to teachers so that they can do that work.
We've got about a minute left. I want to hear from each of you real quickly what your sort of favorite outside resources are for those of us who may not be officially in the classroom already anymore. Rob Good, I'll start with you. What's your favorite sort of post-classroom resource?
I mentioned a few, but another one that I didn't mention that that Kim might find very helpful is the National Museum of African American History and Culture. Their website is remarkable, not just on content, but also on how to have conversations about race.
Quincy Rose, what is your favorite outside source for those of us who are not officially in the classroom anymore?
Yeah, there's two that I want to mention really quickly. There's a program for elementary schools called Social Studies Alive, which is wonderful. If you have a chance, certainly I would recommend that. And then there's a great book that I've been reading, and we did a group read by Christopher Emden for White Folks Who Teach in the Hood, and the rest of y'all too. And it's a great resource as well as it relates to teaching an urban education environment and how we can really do a better job with science and social studies as a whole.
We're going to have to leave it there. Our guests today were Flannery Burke, an associate professor of history at St. Louis University. That was Quincy Rose. She's the dean of the College of Education at Harris Stowe State University. And Rob Good, a retired high school history teacher. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU.
Support comes from the Missouri Forest Products Association, saluting Earth Day on April 22nd with an ongoing commitment to help offset carbon emissions with sustainable harvesting of Missouri forests. Details at choosewood.com.